Shusnarina, Rav Shlita. In our recent shiurim, we were talking about events in England, and we did mention Chacham David Nieto, who was the Rav of the Bevis Mark Synagogue, the Rav of the Sfardim in London, from the year 1701. And we briefly mentioned some of the works that he wrote, and today we're going to concentrate more specifically on his magnum opus, his main work, which was called Kuzari Sheni, or Matei Don. We will also, towards the end, take certain comments of his and apply them to the theme of Rosh Hashanah and conclude with that, given that we've got Tzlicha starting in 1 week's time. Why did he call it the Kuzari Sheni? The first Kuzari was written by Yehuda Halevi about 1,000 years ago, which was a dialogue between the king of the Khuzars and the rabbi in trying to search for truth when various religions were compared and contrasted and discussed, until the king of the Khuzars came to the view that the only truth in the world is Judaism, and he and his people converted. Some say it was a true story, some say it was simply a legend, which was fiction, but Rav Nieto writes in his Sefer Kuzari Sheni, in the way he does the dialogue and continues it between the king of the Khuzars and the rabbi, it's definitely fiction. It's not based on fact, but he carried on the same concept of dialogue between one and another. He speaks in his book about the Karaites and how they got it all wrong, how the Karaites neglected the oral law. But really, in truth, he wasn't really referring to the Karaites. He was referring to people in his own community who had arrived in London from places like Amsterdam, Spain, and where they had been descended from the Anusim, those who were fleeing the persecutions of Spain, those who had been hiding and keeping their religion in secret, and as a result of that, some of them were compromising. That they were saying, well, we'll keep to the written law, but not bother about the oral law. And this alarmed him very much, and that led him to write his Sefer. But in order not to offend directly the people in his community who were making these compromises, the Londoners, he spoke about the Karaites, who was a sect already from a long, long time ago, thousands of years ago, very few of whom still exist. I remember being told once that there is a shul in Ramla of these Karaites. They only accept the written law, not the oral law. And one friend of mine once met one of these people. I said to him, is it really true you only accept the written law, not the oral law? He said, yes. So my friend asked him this question, which the Gemara asks about an eye for an eye. Because the Torah says an eye for an eye, and the Torah Shemal Peh, the oral law, says it can't mean possibly an eye for an eye literally. It must mean monetary compensation. That if you knock out somebody's eye, you have to pay them back the value. And my friend asked him the Gemara question. If you've got two eyes and I've got one eye, then is it fair that if I knock out your eye, you're going to knock out my eye? But the question was so complicated for this fellow, he just couldn't understand it, let alone reach an answer. And what Rav Nieto writes in his Sefer is a convincing proof about the truth of Torah Shebal Peh, of the Oral Law, and also Divrei Chazal, that the words that Chazal used to explain the Torah and to make precautions on the Torah and certain din and Rabbonon. And his Sefer, although it's not very well known, well, it was published by Mossad Rav Kook not that long ago, it was reprinted about 4 years ago, arranged by the Sfardi community in London. But it's not so well known, but the Shagas Aryeh in 1780 made sure it was reprinted because there were no copies left, and he wrote a preface to that edition. The Chidor writes about it in his Shem HaGadolim and praises it. The Chacham Tzvi writes in his Teshuvas about Rav Nieto and praising him and his works in chapter 18 of his Teshuvas. And more recently, Rav Chaim Kanievsky, the son of the Stipler, writes in his Sefer Chai Olam that if a person wants to get good emuna, he should learn the Sefer Nifla Kuzari Sheni. So we'll have a look at some of the ideas coming out from it. When we say the Brocha Shanosanon Taras Emes, we're talking about the Torah Shebiktav, but when we say the Chaya Olam Nota Besochenu, we are referring to the oral law, the Torah Shebal Peh, and this is remarked upon by the Shulchan Aruch himself. And you can't understand the Torah, the written Torah, without the oral law. Says Rav Hirsch, it's like the notes of a lecture. You come out of the lecture, you see the notes, you'll understand it if you were in the lecture. But if you were not in the lecture, you can't understand the notes. And in order to stress the idea to people that there is an oral law, we say after our laning on Shabbos in Yekum Prokom in Shemayo, we talk about the Reishei Mitzivosa, about Chazal, and we also give them importance during the week when we lane from the Sefer Torah, Yiratzav Netanav Inish Bashamayim, L'kayim Bonu Chachme Yisrael, V'samidei, and to stress the idea that the Torah only survives from the oral law. So you might ask me the question, why didn't Hashem just make the whole law written? Why did we have to have an oral law at all? And there are a number of answers to this, but there's one interesting one which comes out from Shmos Rabba, from the Medrash, which says that when Hashem gave the Torah to Moshe at HaSinai, Hashem warned Moshe, he said, in the future, there will be other peoples on the world who will hijack this Torah, who will call it their Torah. They will call it their testament. And in order that they don't understand it properly, it will really only function fully by having a Torah Shebal Peh, by word of mouth, having it handed down from one generation to the next, so that an eye for an eye and all these other explanations will be understood by the people through oral tradition. It was only because there was danger of it being forgotten that it was later written down. And it's amazing, because the Christians and the Muslims, they take our history as their history, as if to say that they are continuing from it, because they want to show that they've got a firm basis. And they have hijacked our Torah. So that is why we have the oral law, because the oral law they just don't understand. And what does it mean by oral law? And if you look at all the mitzvahs of the Torah, really none of them can be understood without the Torah Shebal Peh. For example, Bris Milah. If it's not done, there's a list of courage. Bris Milah, it says, Yimel Basar Oroloso. What does Orolo mean? The Torah uses the word Orolo for an ear, an earlobe, for a mouth. Orolas Levavachem, the heart, the body. It needs the Orolo to tell you exactly where the Bris Milah takes place. On Yom Kippur, also a list of courage, it says, Ve'ini Semes Nafsho Seichem. You shall afflict your souls. Does that mean you have to lie on a bed of nails? Or sit in some sort of hot discomfort the whole day? What does it mean? It doesn't say you shall... Well, it does refer in another pasuk, it alludes to the idea of fasting, but the actual oral law is what tells us what we do, what we can do, what we can't do. There are five inuim on Yom Kippur. Tefillin, tzitzis, it says you shall tie it on your hands. What? What shape is it? What size is it? What's written inside it? What makes it kosher, what makes it not kosher, tzitzis as well, how many knots? All this is oral law. Basar b'cholov, lo tzavasha gadi b'chalei mimo, you may not cook a kid in his mother's milk. That doesn't tell you that you can't mix meat with milk generally. You need the oral law to do so. And when it comes to sukkahs, and it says, ulekachtem lochem, you shall take for yourself pre-eight hodor, you shall take a beautiful fruit. The Mishnah doesn't even ask what is a pre-eight hodor. It just says, what do you take on Sukkot? It says you take three hadasim, you take two arabas, one etrog, and one olive. It doesn't even ask the question, because it takes it for granted. And if there would have been anyone in the world who would have challenged this, they would have done so to say it's not an etrog. But everyone in the world agrees that pre-eight hodor is an etrog. Such is the beauty of Torah Shebal Peh. And then, of course, Hilchas Shabbos. You've got the Lamates Melochas. 39 kinds of labor you can't do on Shabbos. What does the Torah say about Melocha? You mustn't do any Melocha. It says, Nechori Shabbat Kotzir Tishbos. You can't plow, you can't reap from the land. It says, Lo Sivaru Eish B'chol Moshua Seichem. You can't handle fire. It says, Al Yotzi Yishmim Komo, which is an allusion of the carrying. That's four Melochas out of 39. How do you know all the others? 35 Melochas then are not listed in the Torah. How are you going to know? And Shabbos as well is a very severe issue if one breaks it. What the beauty is of Rav David Mieser in his Sefer is when he proves his points of the truth of Torah Shebal Peh, he does it without referring to the Torah Shebal Peh, as if you don't yet believe in it. What he does is he brings proof from the Torah or from the Vayim itself. For example, there's a law about intermarriage. So the Dvarim in chapter 7 says you may not marry amongst the women of the seven nations, the Hittites, the Jebusites, the people who were in Israel. It doesn't talk about intermarriage generally, it just talks about the peoples of that land. to how are you to know that you may not intermarry generally? It doesn't say so anywhere in the Torah. But if you look later on in Melachim, in Perek Aleph, in Melachim Aleph, Perek Yud Aleph, about Shlomo HaMelech, who had many wives, and he didn't think that the Sorim applied to him so much, and he was led astray. And there it lists wives from other nations, such as Mitzrayim, who are not listed in the original Pasuk in Devarim, and it's condemning him for that. So from there we know that intermarriage is Asur. But it's not really written clearly in the Torah itself. But the proofs of the oral law, which are brought by Chacham Nieto, are brought from Tanakh, rather than from the Mishnah and the Gemara directly.
So are we just left on that Shlomo HaMelech didn't know or didn't keep the oral law then?
He accepted that he transgressed. He acknowledged the fact. And afterwards he did teshuva about it. He said, mustn't have many wives, it won't apply to me, because it says, because your heart will be led astray, it won't apply to me. Mustn't have many horses, that kind of thing.
So he knew there was a prohibition.
He knew. Yes. And he was condemned for it. And the way Chacham Nieto says, throughout the Torah, where you see people condemned for something, and it didn't say before, and you may not do it. Cain was punished for killing Hillel, but how did Cain know that you're not allowed to kill? So he says it's obvious that he was told beforehand you're not allowed to kill, otherwise he would have never been punished for it. Yeah, but there has been an oral tradition from the time of creation, that there had been an oral instruction given by Hashem to Adam HaRishon about things that you may not do, such as you may not murder, steal. I mean, what about the mabul, which we say was from gazela, from stealing? So that there was an oral tradition handed down of things you may do and may not do.
I mean, what's disputed?
No, the Sheva Mitzvahs B'nai Noach were handed down to everybody.
No, what I'm saying is that the oral tradition prior to the Matan Torah is acknowledged by everybody. Sure, it's in the Old Testament. It's obviously the case. It's only the oral tradition at Matan Torah which is disputed. Right? There's no truth in kind, is what I'm saying. So.
Yeah, I understand what you're saying. As far as the Karaites are concerned, they're talking about from Matan Torah. Yeah. I understood. But the idea of oral tradition was much earlier than that. And one of the reasons he says why we read Rus on Shavuos, there are many reasons, but Rus, we read on Shavuos, which is the time of Matan Torah, and the Torah says, you do not marry, it says, into the Moabite, and the Torah Sheval Peh, the oral says, Moavi lo Moavis. Boaz married a Moavis, or someone who was a Moavis, and so it's to tell you that the oral law is intrinsic to the written law at the time of Shavuos when we're talking about Kabbalah HaTorah. And even if you think the rabbis are wrong in something that they say, it says, Lo sasur min hadavar shi'a gudu l'chol, you may not turn away from the law which they teach you, yominu sumol, to the right or to the left. So we say, and Rashi brings this down, even if they say that right is left and left is right, you still listen to Chazal. And it's very interesting because there's a custom we have on Simchas Torah when we do Hagbah on the Sefer Torah. Once we finish reading the Sefer Torah, what do? The hands are switched, and the right and the left hands are interchanged. And a reason given for this by Rav Maimon, who gives a commentary on this Sefer of Kuzari Sheni, is because that now that we've read the Torah Shebiksav, the written law, remember that there's also an oral law, that even if you call right left and left right, you have to listen, and that's why we do the Hagbah that way around.
Actually, I just want to say that Rashi quotes the difference, the Rashi is completely different. As you get the same movement, it's not exactly the opposite. Until they tell you, you're right, it's right.
Yeah.
We always learn one tradition, not the other. So we only learn one, not the other.
Yeah, but I think we've got the message. Yeah. And so the question which the Kuzar asks the rabbi in this Sefer Kuzari Sheni is, I can understand that Lo Sosor is that when the rabbis interpret a law of the Torah, you must listen to them. But what right do the rabbis have to make laws up of their own? There are seven or so different laws which they made up. And not only are they laws which they made up, but we say the Brocha Shekidah Shonu B'mitzvosov V'tzivonu, that Hashem commanded us. When you wash your hands for Hamotzi, Al Netilas Adayim, you're saying V'tzivonu. But nowhere in the Torah does it say you have to wash your hands for Motzi. And there are other mitzvahs to Rabbonon. Eruv, there are three kinds of Eruv. Eruv Tafshilin, Eruv Techumin, Eruv Chatzeros. lighting the Shabbos light, the Yontov light. We say Hashem Kedoshonu b'mitzvosof v'tzivonu. Where in the Torah does it say Hashem commanded us? Ner Chanukah, Megillah, Hallel. There are also the Sheva Brachos, but that's not Hashem Kedoshonu b'mitzvosof v'tzivonu. But on these where we say v'tzivonu, he asks, how can you rely on lo sosur when lo sosur is really just to give you the explanations of the existing laws? But what right do the rabbis have to make up new laws? So he says, the rabbis have not made up any new laws. It's true that we call them dinim d'rabbonon. But if you look at the thrust of the things written by Hashem in the written law, you learn out these ideas. The Tilas Yodayim, Chazal given us machta, viskadashtem, yisem kadoshim, cleanliness is next to godliness, that you shall be refined in your ways, yisem nakiyim, it's part and parcel of what the Torah wants from you. As far as lighting the Shabbos lights are concerned, we say the cross on a Shabbos oneg, and there's no oneg without light. You have to have light if you're going to have oneg. When it comes to praising Hashem in Hallel with Ner Chanukah and Megillah, what are we praising Hashem? We're thanking Him. Throughout the Torah, you find the idea of giving thanks. Noach offers a korban. Avraham Avinu offers a korban. We've got the Oz Yoshe, how we give thanks to Hashem when we sing our praises for Him. David HaMelech, the Tehillim. We say V'gad Solovincho, when we have our Seder night, it's to give thanks to Hashem. V'chaltzav Savot HaVerachto, when you bench for after your meal, you give thanks to Hashem. So all this, says Chacham Nieto, is part and parcel of the idea that we have to show our gratitude. Hakoras HaTov is a din min HaTorah. So what the rabbis were doing were encapsulating this idea into these new things, which were Ner Chanukah, Megillah, and Hallel, when we're praising and thanking Hashem. What about Eruv? Eruv, first of all, when it talks about Eruv Tafshilin, not to prepare from one day onto to the next, it talks about Lehechinu Es HaSheyoviu, to respect each day of holiness on its own. And on Erev Chatzeres and Erev Tuchumin, he brings in the din of Neder. That these are things true, which we accepted upon ourselves. But once we accepted them upon ourselves, they have a din of Neder. And therefore, it is legitimate to say also, Hashem Kedoshonu b'mitzvosof v'tzivonu. The first three chapters of the Kuzari Sheni deal with these ideas of how we learn the Torah Sheva Peh to be of most considerable importance, and how Divrei Chazal have to be respected. In his fourth chapter, he deals with a completely different subject, and that is sciences. He tried to make it his job to find out as much as he could about the subject, even though for us, the sciences of those days was comparatively primitive. There's one biographer who says that he was in touch with Sir Isaac Newton and communicated with him, and he was very interested in such subjects. And in the beginning of the fourth chapter, he quotes about Tanur and Sanhedrin in the tenth chapter, where it's frowned upon to study external books about Greek philosophy and sciences and so on. And the Rashba issued a cherem against those who were studying Greek philosophy in his Tshuvas in chapter 415, 417. And so the Kuzza asks the rabbi, how is it possible then to study these things? And the whole thrust of the fourth chapter is to understand sciences like mathematics, which will help us understand the Torah. And he answers him, first of all, the Baruch Tanur is one opinion only about saying no external secular books. And if you look at Hilchos Shabbos, it talks about those books which you don't read on Shabbos, Sifrei Chochmas, which therefore may be read during the weekdays. And he says the Rashba's Gezeira against those who are studying Greek philosophy was only for under 25-year-olds, and it was only a 50-year ban, to show if it would have been a serious thing, he would have made a permanent ban. And he says how the Kabbalists quote various non-Jewish philosophers like Aristotle, Plato, Aquinas, to confirm the truth of the Torah. So that's the fourth chapter, and in the fifth chapter he deals with his pet subject, which is Kiddush HaChodesh, the Jewish calendar, which we once discussed before. We're going to move on to one specific idea which he brings in his Sefer in the third chapter, in paragraph 113, and that is about shofar, which we're now blowing every morning. And he speaks about the din of shofar, which of course is not specified in the written law as to what sort of shofar it is, what sort of trumpet it is. Maybe it should be a clarinet or a recorder. We've got the oral law to tell us what we blow. Shofar shall ayil. And he talks about the gezeirah which Chazal made not to blow the shofar when Rosh Hashanah falls on Shabbos. Well, this year it falls on a weekday, and there'll be a few years still before it falls again on a Shabbos, but we're going to pull out some ideas from this. The Gemara in Rosh Hashanah, Kaftes on the base, talks about the gezeirah of Yom Tov Shel Rosh Hashanah Shecholios b'Shabbos. We do not blow the shofar. Well, Yushalayim v'lo b'medina. Yushalayim ain shavus b'mikdosh. There's no rabbinical stringencies in the mikdosh. And Yushalayim, there's a machlokas we're showing him about, the town of Yushalayim. But Chazal said, you don't blow the shofar. And that means even if there's a kasher eruv, you don't blow the shofar. Shema yeleh ketel bakilil. No, the person might go and to a teacher, the avirenu daradamas b'shosaravim, and he will carry four amas in a public place. And for that reason, Chazal said, don't blow the shofar. The Torah says, blow. You don't blow. Even with a Hereruv, you don't blow. Why? Because somebody else, somewhere else, might carry a shofar in the street on Shabbos. It doesn't say that you might forget yourself and carry it to shul. A lot of people think that it's because you might forget it and carry it to shul. There is a Tosfos in Rosh Hashanah which says, that's not why the gezeirah was made. Because if you forget yourself and carry it to shul, then It's not an issur kares, right? But here we're dealing with a case of somebody else who will want to learn how to blow the shofar, bring it to a teacher, and will carry. And this is amazing, because when you think about it, there's a sfeikah here. Perhaps a person will find the shofar in the street, and perhaps he will carry Dalad Amash Bishul Saravim. So there's a sfeikah here, and then, you know, this is very strange. So Chacham Nieto says something amazing which I haven't seen anywhere else. When the Kuzar asks him, why did Chazal make such a din? He answers in an amazing way. He says, for the same reason that a sick person is told to eat on Yom Kippur. So the Kuzari says, "Mi amin l'shmoscha? How can anybody believe what you're saying? What's Rosh Hashanah and Sukkot, Lulav, got to do with Yom Kippur when a person's life is in danger? Obviously a person has to eat on Yom Kippur. You can't say that he has to eat, but here, you know, there's no life in danger." He said, there is a life in danger. He said, this person who Chazal were talking about, who will find the shofar, will know that it's osur to carry on Shabbos. He will do it b'mezid. He will do it on purpose. The lo b'shogeg. What does this mean? He will be so keen to perform the ritual of Rosh Hashanah, and he talks in the history about how many ignorant people there were who wanted to keep Torah mitzvahs, but they had no education to do so. So they want to perform the ritual, and somebody will come and warn the guy, but Aidim, Basra, listen, you're not allowed to carry, and the fellow will say, no, I still want to perform the mitzvah of shofar. How do we understand this mentality? Chacham Nieto said he'll do it on purpose. We only have to look around, unfortunately, nowadays, that there are some people who will even drive their car to shul on Shabbos because they want to attend the ritual of the synagogue service. They think it's more important. They park round the corner because they know the rabbi doesn't like it. But they'll still do a malacha because they don't regard the lower test malachas as being that important. But they want to attend the synagogue service. And if we want to bring this mentality a bit more forward, let me read out to you an email I received not long ago. I was going to, owing to various circumstances, stay in an area over Shabbos where there is an Orthodox synagogue, one of the constituent United synagogues, and I was emailing them to find out about their times of service. So they told me, and they wrote back to me saying, we're looking forward to seeing you. And then they wrote to me, due to the enhanced security alert surrounding the Olympics, our security officer has asked me if you would kindly let me know your address and telephone number. Fine, very nice. Okay, I did that. He says, when you come to the synagogue, could you please bring your passport? That would be appreciated. With my thanks, signed by the warden. This is an Orthodox synagogue belonging to the United Synagogue. So I wrote back to him, I said, dear Mr. So-and-so, I cannot yet confirm my attendance, but it's likely that I shall be needing to stay in the area for the duration of Shabbat. As I am an Orthodox Jew, and you are an Orthodox congregation, the carrying of items in the street is forbidden on Shabbat. How am I therefore expected to bring my passport if I do not arrive before the commencement of Shabbat? And how am I meant to bring away my passport if you do not have a service at the termination of Shabbat? Because they had a Friday evening service and a Shabbos morning service, but no Shabbos evening service. And then in a rather subtle, cynical way, I wrote, perhaps I should ask the chief rabbi's office? Thank you and regards. So I got back a reply by email. Dear Mr. Pick, thank you very much for letting us have your contact details. I hope that you'll accept my apology for having to ask you about the passport, but regrettably it is something which one is obliged to ask for in these troubled times. We do know that an Orthodox Jew may reply as you did, but nevertheless we have to follow certain visitor procedures upon the advice of the CST, with our shul being in the location that it is. We do hope you'll be confirming your visit and look forward to welcoming you. So, there you have it. The words of Harav Nieto coming to light. They want the ritual. They have to have the synagogue service. All right, you might argue Pekuah Nefesh, but do I really look like a security threat? Right. Yeah, okay, okay. Well,
but if you turned up now without your passport, they know who you are, they'd let you in.
As it happened, I gave them the name of someone who they know who knows me, but in the end I decided I'm not going. I mean, all right, we won't go into that in detail now, but this mentality that the ritual has to be performed, this was the foresight of Chazal. They could understand how people behave. Now, let's just bring this a bit further. The shofar which we blow on Rosh Hashanah, this is not just like any mitzvah saseh. You know, there are lots of mitzvahs, I say, where if you can't blow, you're onus, you can't help it. You can't lay tefillin because you haven't got a pair, you're onus, you can't help it. So you don't get punished for it. But shofar is different. Shofar is very different. This is brought out not only by Chacham Nieto, but also by the Meshech Chochma, where he talks about Zichra and Zeruah. Shofar, if you don't blow shofar, you're putting yourself in danger, because Chazal say in the Medrash that when Hashem hears the voice of the sound of the shofar, he gets up from his kisei din and he sits on his kisei rachamim. He leaves strict justice alone and he sits on the seat of mercy. Such Hashem feels for Klal Yisrael when they blow the shofar. Why the shofar shall ail? Because it reflects on the Akedah, on Akedah Yitzchok. Hashem remembers the Akedah Yitzchok, how Yitzchok was prepared to sacrifice himself, and he sees how we put ourselves out. This is a pikuach nefesh here, surely. For a sex faker that somebody might carry a shofar in the street on Shabbos, we stop blowing the shofar even when there's an Eruv, aren't our lives are in danger? Because if Midas Hadin doesn't turn to Midas Rachamim, then we've all got problems. So how do we succeed in making Hashem hofech his Midas Hadin to Midas Rachamim? This question is asked by the Sefer Mishmeres Kahuna, Rav Meir Yechiel Alevi, was the Admiral of Ostrovtsa, and it's also alluded to by the Meshech Chochma. When we refrain from blowing the shofar on Shabbos, we are putting ourselves into a matzav of risking our lives, just like Yitzchak Avinu risks his life. And because we're doing that, because we are risking ourselves, in order to listen to Divrei Chazal, to conform to what Chazal say, Hashem says, don't worry, you'll be alright. Because we're putting ourselves in the same category as Yitzchak Avinu in the Akedah. When he put his life on the line, we are putting our lives on the line by not blowing the shofar. Because we're listening to Divrei Chazal. We can also spell out the importance of Shabbos. And the Gemara says, Kli Aviyarcho. We're not sure if it's Yom Tov, but we know that it's Shabbos, and Shabbos is the Oath, and we stand for Shabbos. And to protect Kedushas Shabbos, we will not blow the shofar, even when there's just a precautionary measure. And there is another idea here, which is brought out by the Chasam Sofer. He says, Yitzchok was greater, we say, than Avraham Avinu. Avraham Avinu had the test. Yitzchok didn't have the test. Of course he had a test, but for Yitzchok, it was clear cut that he would follow what Avraham had told him to do. But hold on a minute. Avraham was told by Hashem what to do. Yitzchok wasn't told by Hashem what to do. He was told by Avraham what to do. So when Avraham listens to Hashem, that's like the written law. That's directly from Hashem. But when Yitzchok listens to his father, That's like the Torah Shabbal Peh. It's compared to the oral law which he's conforming to. So Yitzchok is regarded as greater than Avram because he thinks, Shelo lahare al divrei chachomim, I'm not going to question what chachomim are saying. That my father is a Novi, my father is a chachom, I will listen to what he says. That's why it's the aisle. There's one more idea which comes out from this. There's a lot of ritual on Rosh Hashanah. Yom Kippur, we have, of course, the Kapporos, we have Tashlich, we have the white peroches, the white covers, we have the lovely tunes. None of this is really din, but it's all ritual which people want to go for and pursue, and it's all very nice. And we've spoken about how to put the ritual in perspective. Let's not sacrifice the Lamates Malochus on Shabbos, which is of more paramount importance. But what is the idea behind worrying about another Jew whom we're not familiar with, we're not acquainted with, who might carry on Shabbos? And as a result of that, we're putting our lives on the line. We are risking ourselves. We are worried about the fate of another Jew who will be chayav misa for carrying on Shabbos. We are risking ourselves by not having the shofar blown on Shabbos, by not having Hashem directly going from midas din to midas rachamim. Why? So that we care. We care about our fellow Jew with whom we're not acquainted, because he'll be chayav misa, in the words of Chacham Nieto, because he's doing an avera b'mezid. This is profound. This is Avas Yisrael. But when it comes to Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur, we're so busy davening in our relationship between ourselves and our Kodesh Baruch Hu. Yeah, with all our banging on our chest, and we're talking about our mitzvahs which we have been transgressing. Bein Odom L'Mokom. Okay, in the Al-Chayt it talks about Sinas Chinom, it talks about relationships with other people. But the emphasis on Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur is very much in line with Bein Odom L'Mokom. And we often forget to ask Mechila from our friends and enemies for the wrongs that we have done, and that's also part and parcel of Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur. The lesson which Chazal were teaching us by prohibiting the shofar on Shabbos is that the person who we don't know, the Jew who will be chayav misa for breaking Shabbos, we are worried about. And if we can enter the Yomim Haroim with that in mind, that we're worried about our fellow man. Just last week I was staying in a town in Israel where it was 100% Haredi. It's beautiful. You don't see any distractions. It's marvelous. But are we in such places thinking about our fellow Jews who are not as fortunate as we are? Are we reaching out to them and giving them the beauty of Yiddishkeit, which we have to share with them, that we have to worry about them? We are worried about the welfare of this Pentalayid who wants to carry on Shabbos to do a mitzvah. We have to reach out to him and show him how to do the mitzvahs, because he wants to keep them. He's not a Tinek Shenishba. We have to reach out. And with that Avas Yisrael, with that feeling of how we should share our Yiddishkeit with others, we can be Zocha then to Ksiva Machsima Tova, a good Gemetz Shtia for all Klal Yisrael, for a Shnas Gula Vishua. Ksiva Machsima Tova.